Paul Wilson University of Nottingham in the UK. It strikes me we've had a lot of interesting presentations just then, and particularly Will, that last talk I found illuminating. I'd like to ask the panel about their thoughts on the issue of price spikes in the very immediate nature of them, because whilst we can talk about increasing prices and we can talk about how we can deal with that, it's the actual immediacy of those price spikes that is the reality for consumers. So it's no good putting a policy in place that corrects for that 2 weeks after the event, because those consumers are faced with a price spike when it happens. So how do we design policies that can help consumers when those price spikes occur, rather than just try to do some analysis after the event, so to speak?
Okay. One can certainly use, but my response would be in the framework of the low-income developing country. I guess there are different countries who can respond differently too. I mean, the one thing in many African countries, Eastern and Southern Africa, so let's put it that way, the countries I worked extensively in the last few years, you can actually use a lot of early warning system information from the range of providers. FuseNet is an excellent provider, Finance by the USA is the early warning system, and WFP is also an early warning system, which can predict what will happen in the next 6 months with your crop. So you can actually be ready quite in advance to respond. But once price spiked and the government has an option how to respond, and some responses are better than others and some responses are worse than others, as I tried to show in the presentation. You know, my immediate, because I manage the Global Food Price Response Program in the bank, one of the trust funds we have, and we always have those types of questions, what are the first best solution? If the country has a safety net, the easiest way and the quickest way actually to address the temporary problem, because if the food price spike is temporary problem, the best way is to have the temporary increase scale up of the safety net. For those, if you can easily identify, if you can target, if you have the targeting population, low administrative cost, safety net, I guess, that's the best response. The second, if the import tariffs are high and you can import, you can reduce your import tariffs from a certain point to zero, you can also reduce the cost to some periods of time. And third, if your import tariff is zero, if you don't have safety net, which is the case in most countries, I mean, not in the most, but in the many countries, especially in the West, and in the West Africa, I would say, regarding rice, the import tariff is not as high as one can actually reduce costs, and there are no safety nets in place. So the best short-term response is to production stimulus to get a better harvest next year. But to manage that, one needs to really take into account different things, not to divert resources from the long term. Thanks.
Any other comments from the okay. Next question.
Caroline Bate from McGill University. I guess this question is directed mainly to, or to anyone, but to Dudley Adolf in particular. Your area had quite a large production of wine production, which I assume was for export. And you were also saying it was 40% of the horticulture was going towards feeding South Africa. Like, your policy decisions, when you talk about irrigation or needs for irrigation or needs for smallholder development or whatever, how do you balance that with your export, your rather major export area, which I assume is very important to the South African economy?
Thank you for that. Very good question. For us, as most of our production is in the island, it's the serious fruit wine production for exports, and it contributes to about 180,000 permanent employment for the people in the rural area. So it's important to have it there, and it also earns us a lot of foreign currency. So for us is to look at efficiencies of water use. Our policy is totally to move to drip irrigation and to move away from flood irrigation and all the other types. And secondly also is to increase the productivity on wine farms itself. For example, you find that on a wine farm there's 50 hectares not being productive, where you put tunnels up for other types of production and diversifying and doing partnerships with the wine farm and a smallholder farmer to look at how we use these access to the markets and all the systems that they have already to be able to have a partnership in terms of production. We're also looking at the desalination of brackish water. We've got a lot of brackish water in our area to give access to people especially for small stock farming and so forth for that purpose. And also expansion of dams is big on our agenda to be able to unlock more land that's edible for irrigation purposes.
Go ahead.
My name is Annabelle. I'm at Media University in International Development. I worked for the summer in Uganda, and when I was working in a community, the farmers in rural area were really willing to gather and expand their business, but there was no funds, and it's always what they were saying: "We have no money, so we cannot do anything. We cannot gather and we cannot send our stuff in the big cities because we have no roads and the government is doing nothing." And it was always the issue of asking us, do you know any way for us to get money from somewhere? So I don't know if you have anything to say. I know that this worked in Uganda.
Putting in this one. Yes, I'm absolutely right. The problem is really where the most needs are, and the countries with the least money. And the money is always a problem, and that's why it's very important to actually wisely use this very limited resource. And there are many problems in Uganda. Uganda is actually has been progressing and developing quite well in the regional perspective. When you look on the record of economic growth and the poverty reduction, that economic growth was quite poor. You compare with the countries, Tanzania, Kenya around, they had Zambia, they had very nice economic growth, 6-7% of GDP in the last 7-6 years, but poverty reduction is almost zero. In Uganda, we have very strong elasticity of growth and poverty, meaning that their policies are quite well, on the one hand. On the other hand, there is still a real problem under investment in the rural areas. The transport cost per ton of kilometer is, we talk about probably 20, 30 cents per ton of kilometer, just move commodity from point A to point B per 1 kilometer. Here in the US, probably talk about 5 cents per ton of kilometer. China, 3 cents per ton of kilometer. Just 6 times higher marketing costs. Just make it not profitable to produce many crops. So the government need to invest, but need to invest better, because the fiscal costs are always limited there, and it will be some time, unfortunately.
Can I just perhaps add, we must be very careful when the development that we do is especially how you're going to spend it and what type of assistance you're going to give. Giving assistance directly doesn't necessarily yield good results, because you create a situation of a one-yield dependency. After your first yield, your harvest is sold, next year you come in one more money to put a harvest up. So it's important how you do it. And also to focus on the training part, the access to market parts, on the expansion part, those are the areas that people should focus on in that area, because our advice to our farmers is, if you can't sell it, don't produce it. If you're in an area where there's no connectivity, you will sell locally. If you can't sell locally, don't produce it. Why are you producing something that you can't sell? So we must be very careful on how that assistance is given and how it's coordinated.
Could I just add to your question on my own, and that is, what about microcredit? Where's the role of microcredit and access to credit for these farmers? Perhaps that was part of the question.
And I think, also maybe I didn't say, but what is the role of the government, Ugandan government versus the international community? I mean, if there's no help from the government, we have our place.
Yeah, you see, if I must, I don't want to discuss the subsidy issue and how governments get involved, but let's go to microcredit, for example. In our country, our rents are very high, interest rate. And if you look at the margins of farmers, it's very low. So if you go to a bank and you get a microcredit, you'll pay 8% interest on it. And you cannot farm that out for the next 6 years to 7 years. So there must be government assistance in the form of a grant. So we give grants, but we mix it. We mix lending with grants, training, and a certain program we put in place. That is what government should do. But government shouldn't be there to pay for the profits of a farmer, if you know what I'm saying. You know, it should be there to assist for them to start working over a period, but have a clear exit strategy. So we're very clear on it. For the specific commodity, let's take wine. Only 5 years you can harvest, but let's take vegetables. You can harvest 3 times a year. So your exit strategy gets determined and your assistance gets determined on the type of crop and commodity that you're going to assist. That's what we do in the Western Cape for our developing farmers.
Next question.
Yes. My name is Dr.
Lafayette.
I'm first of all, again, some very good presentations. Very much appreciated. I'm not even certain quite how to ask the question. We almost have the sense, from what I'm hearing, not only in this panel but previously on price volatility, that we see a spike and we rush to assist. And when the spike goes away, we forget everything about what caused the spike, and we have no memory of what we've lost. I guess my biggest concern is that we went through the 2008 spike. We told a lot of countries in the world that if you would just trust international trade, then we can assist in the food issues around the world. Well, the 2008 spike told everyone that they can't trust the markets. We've lost that. It's part of what is slowing the WTO negotiations. So I don't see it as once it goes away, we are back to somehow a normal situation. We have lost a lot in terms of the trust, not only within nations, but across nations in how markets work.
Would you like to comment?
Come on,
Will. I think we do see ratchets and regimes in which we move from one regime to another. You know, you make a point about international trade, others have too. I think that's central. This other theme of ratcheting to one regime or another of investment in public goods. Rationing to one regime or another of a sense of the role of government. The question that was just asked, you know, how much role should government play in farm credit? In response to that question, in the 1970s, there was a sense that the government should be the provider of credit in rural areas. And then all of that was swept away, and perhaps it will come back. Likewise, on one issue that we haven't talked about at all today, surprisingly, is fertilizer subsidies. That had been the sense that that was government's job to subsidize in the 60s and 70s, and then that went away, and now it's perhaps back on. So we are ratcheting between regimes, and I think it's a very good point that right now the next regime is in question. And it's a very open question on each of these issues, what plateau we'll move to.
To add a little bit on that, I mean, I think you're quite right on the trade side in general, but if you look at maybe a more positive aspect of that, India and China never thought, of course, that they could rely on trade because the quantities necessary are way beyond the amounts that are traded globally. So the kinds of policies in place to protect domestic consumers turned out to actually work for their populations, possibly with detrimental effects elsewhere or exacerbating price rises and so on. On the other hand, if you look especially at the rice situation, there just was no rice available, which is why when Thailand or Philippines then was interested in purchasing rice on the international market when India stopped exports, there just wasn't any rice available, and then the price really shot up. And that certainly, I think, stimulated the idea that, you know, really we have to, you know, countries have to be somewhat more self-sufficient in this than they had been. On another aspect of that, similarly, in 2008, a number of Central American countries were looking to purchase seeds in order to expand production for the next year. And again, couldn't find any seeds on the market. Their seed industry had been, you know, had kind of gone downward, disintegrated, or evaporated altogether. And, you know, there was just the complacency that, you know, this would work, and there shouldn't have been complacency. So I think the extent of which, let's say, confidence in trade deteriorated could certainly be a bad thing, but the extent of which confidence that there would always be some other possibility that others, that you don't need to invest in this because you could always turn to the international market, may not be a bad thing, actually, for, especially for something like seeds.
I may add, trade is the low-cost solution to the food security problems any country may have. You have surplus, you can export, you have deficit, you can import, right? And you don't need budget to private companies to do that. It's easy budget. So if the government is responsible, it will always be able to build those solutions. Okay, if we have the political complications of using those solutions, the future tells us, and the future forecast tells us that very likely the countries with the highest population density will be hit the most by the climate change. So one of the presentations, and I don't remember today, was the mismatch between the land and population in East, South Asia, and others in Africa. And the future is even more extreme for those countries, so they have less food per capita. There's no alternative for trade in those places. There's no alternative for trade. And the longer the countries delay adjustment, the painful they will be. So it's time now to come together to understand the importance of trade. Don't look at trade as a silver bullet, but certainly look at trade as something which can help instead of creating problems. Thank you.
Next question.
Hi, Chris Savard from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on the effectiveness of G20 initiatives like the AMIS, the Agricultural Markets Information System, and the Rapid Response Forum, when many emerging countries are reluctant or unable to share information on commodities?
I'm actually participating in that. I made you in your debt from FAO, okay. AMIS is exactly the project to try to solve that problem. So many emerging countries, we know, I mean, the FAO, who is a sort of the organization which collects the statistics from the world and tries to make the best use of it in terms of different outlooks, short-term, long-term outlooks, price outlooks, etc., to tell the world where we are and what the problems we face with food security. And yes, indeed, the quality of information we receive from many important emerging economies are not satisfactory to us. And the AMIS is exactly the reaction to that gap. The AMIS was launched, Agricultural Market Information System, was launched in Rome in September 16. It was agreed by all G20 members who committed to provide information on a regular basis and work on improving the quality of information, including its carbonization. You don't want just to know how much stocks is there, but you want also to know how stocks are estimated. You want to know how production is estimated, how consumption is estimated, etc. It sounds easy, but it's not as easy. So we want to also not just the numbers, but we want to understand what's behind the numbers. And the G20 countries agreed to cooperate and have the dialogue on that and try to improve the quality of information at the end. Important element of that rapid response forum, rightly said, it's an opportunity again with these AMIS to create a platform for G20 members, limited number, 20 countries plus 7 non-G20 members, but important for the world markets will be invited. to have the early discussion in the case we think that we head into an abnormal market situation. Because when the food prices are already high, it's already done, it's maybe already too late to respond. So we wanted to really know the early warning system. We wanted to set the indicators at the global level and to have the senior policymakers around the table to quickly discuss that. So the technical people from the international organization, the first time probably in the history decided to work together on this issue and to provide those facts to the policymakers, and it's up to them to really make decisions. But we just hope that we can avoid a situation we had in 2008 where unnecessary decisions were made to exaggerate the problem, not to help.
My colleague from FAO, David Allen, is the real expert on this, who spoke this morning, and I'm always less comfortable in responding on FAO topics when the real FAO person is in the room. But in any case, it is a very interesting question. And for those of you who haven't followed this, this AMOS is a new agreement to get more transparency, as Sergey has mentioned, particularly on stocks, so that we have a better handle, actually, on how much food is out there, and as a way of reducing volatility and better information and so on. What I think is particularly interesting from FAO's point of view on this, a lot of what we do applies to all countries, and a lot of, sort of by definition, what we work on are global public goods in a sort of a broader sense, where every country, whether you are large or small, need to be engaged and to benefit from this. This particular case is, however, for a subset of countries where really what you need is really good information from a subset, since there aren't that many countries that are big importers and exporters. So if you add the G20 plus 7, you pretty much have the market, not 100% of the market, but you have a really good idea with a relatively few number of countries. And this for us, I think, is a real interesting new direction, along with World Bank and the others, France, OECD, and others that are participating in this. If I'm wrong on that, David will correct me later.
We have 2 minutes, so if you could have a very quick question.
Sure. I'm Aaron from McGill School of Environment. This question is directed mostly to the last person who spoke. Many of the Green Revolution's positive impacts were pushed by high inputs of fossil fuels, especially through artificial fertilization, and also in East Asia by extensive control of irrigation and water management. But right now, East Asian countries, and especially China and India, are facing huge water management issues in the next decade. And simultaneously, climate change, which was perpetuated by extensive use of fossil fuels, is expected to bring about huge changes in weather patterns. So what do you think this implies for food security? I'm pretty skeptical that the recent agricultural successes will be as long-lasting as we might hope they are. So what does this imply for food security, and how does this impact what you call the demographic gift? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would totally agree. The original Green Revolution technologies are not the answer for Africa. We know that because they've had about 30 years to try, and they haven't been the answer. But that's not to say that science and technology isn't the answer, right? So they did R&D in a very fossil fuel intensive way and a very water intensive way for the Gangetic Plain, for the irrigated rice of East Asia, because they had a lot of water and a lot of fossil fuels, and it made perfect sense. And now you turn R&D to water use efficiency, drought resistance. You turn it towards nitrogen efficiency and the micro-placement example that we saw this morning. You turn it to the genetics of heat resistance, the genetics of other traits that you want. There were, you didn't mention it, but there were big nutritional failings in the original Green Revolution because it was all about calorie needs at that time. And now we're much more interested in micronutrient density and so forth. But they are equally amenable targets to crop breeding, which is the real amazing thing here. It's the plasticity of plants to take varieties that were that evolved and were selected by farmers in the very micro ecosystems around the world and transport those across, if you will, time and space, right, to make what are called wide crosses that are not available to any farmer in a normal circumstance. So there's material from Central America with material from Africa, material from Asia with material from Europe. And to make those crosses over and over and over again, unimaginably broad exploitation of biological diversity, of biodiversity in ways that are not available to any farmer, and then choose what works best and deploy it, that's something that people cannot do for themselves, individual countries cannot do for themselves. And if we don't do it for them, it won't happen. But it clearly, we can't use the tools from before. We need to do new tools. We need to do new R&D.
So with that call to all researchers, I would like to thank very much for an exceptional panel and thank all of you for participating and offering wonderful questions. Let's see, I'm asked to remind you that there is an evaluation form to please fill out. We will have a 15-minute break. And please join me in thanking the panel.